Chapter 18. A Naked Lunch with Violin. The catastrophe unfolded in my and Mo's absence. It was rapid and devastating, and it's quite possible that the only reason I'm around to record this account of the event is because I wasn't there. I feel compelled to raise my hand and admit that I'm partly to blame. I'm no more to blame than everyone else on the senior auditor's ad hoc working group, but no less. If we'd realized that Basil had infiltrated the Dresden Rice Committee, hell, if it had occurred to us that our mole might come in the guise of an elderly, low-level administrative employee, we might have paid more attention to reducing the threat surface of the working group. But he'd been working his mind-fogging magic within our halls since before I was born. He predates the senior auditor. He was certainly here during the organization's salad days, as part of SOE during the Second World War. He predates Angleton. He was a careful planner, and although he operated at a relatively low level, he had access to all our non-current HR files and declassified internal records. Consequently, he got inside our event loop, with fatal consequences. While we thought we were very cleverly mousetrapping our adversary at an off-site location of our choice, our adversary was simultaneously mousetrapping our away team, and tricking his oldest, deadliest enemy into a suicidal assault on the new annex, promoted by a trickle of cunning lies and assisted by the loan of a warrant card, keys, and a floor plan. Actually, this had been on the cards for a very long time. Months, certainly. Possibly for years, maybe even for decades. After all, the first rule of vampires is, vampires don't exist, and the elders take its enforcement as a matter of deadly importance. So a corollary of this rule is that any viable strategy for eliminating an old and powerful rival is going to be non-obvious. There are a couple of long-term survival strategies open to the occult practitioner who has let the wrong symbiote in. One of these is to hunker down and squat, invisible, in the center of a miasmic mist of misleading magic that befuddles and bamboozles anybody who speculates about your existence. The leading proponent of this strategy, the strategy of the hedgehog, was the late Basil Northcote Robinson, and it served him well, up to a point. The other leading strategy is to turn the fang's ability to compel belief to the accretion of wealth and power, and to use those accumulated assets to build a pearl, layering protective nacre around your sand-grain heart. This strategy, the strategy of the fox, is the one that old George Stevenson employed. What kind of vampire elder owns a founder's stake in one of the nation's largest investment banks? Answer: one who is not afraid to take risks in the pursuit of profit. First, Basil nudged us into taking old George's scrum-shaped experiment away from him. Then he bamboozled old George into loaning him not Marianne the assassin, by presenting a common front. Finally, he removed himself from the firing line, warned old George that the laundry working group on Fangs was coming for him, and thereby triggered a game of let's you and him fight. Foxes are fast movers, and they bite. At precisely 7:03, at exactly the moment that I'm rolling around in Stephen Howe's intestines with ringing ears, as a demented vampire hunter with a pistol and a selection of explosives tries to kill me, old George launches an assault on the new annex. If he was able to call on the support of all his minions, you would not be hearing this account of his attack. But Basil has cunningly stripped him of his deadliest proxies and waved the flag of an immediate threat before him. There is insufficient notice to prepare adequately for the offensive. Old George is therefore winging it. Old George is very well informed for an outsider. He knows about the night watch. He knows about our alarm systems. Finally, old George is armed for bear. He may be desperate, but he's also a 200-year-old ritual magician and occult practitioner who is immune to Kay syndrome and a vampire on top. At this time of evening, the building is largely deserted. The cleaners have been and gone. A couple of nightwatch bodies roam the ground floor and basement level. Lights burn on the second floor, in a couple of briefing rooms and the duty officer's den. So it is that when a black Mercedes pauses briefly outside the main entrance and a man gets out, nobody is paying enough attention to the external CCTV feed. Old George wears a charcoal grey trench coat with its collar turned up, and a Homburg pulled low over his ears. The trench coat conceals a multitude of sins, not least of which is a silk lining that old George has embroidered by hand himself over a period of many months, with enough defensive wards and charms to armour an aircraft carrier. The hat has properties of its own, its brim casting a shadow that renders the wearer's face unrecognisable. Anonymous and all but invisible, he marches up to the front door of the new annex and touches the keypad. The pad smokes as he lets himself in. In the darkness of the lobby, a shuffling caretaker hisses as it approaches the intruder. Old George has heard of these revenants, the residual human resources that gave their all for the organisation and now give even more, and he is amused to see the faint swirl of green luminosity within the sunken eyes of the shambler.
"Lie down,"
he suggests, not unkindly, and reaching out with a gloved finger, he taps the night watchman on the forehead, right inside the span of its outstretched arms. The corpse wheezes faintly as it collapses, the breath fleeing its flaccid lungs for the last time. Old George turns towards the staircase. Then he begins to climb. George is here because Basil has manoeuvred him into a coffin corner, and the shortest way out is through the laundry with guns blazing. This latest move in the game they've been playing for 7 decades began almost by accident, with the laundry's move out of Dancy House. For the first time in more than half a century, Basil found himself unprotected by the subtle, powerful, and extensive Gesh that he had spent so much energy constructing, the compulsion to disbelieve in vampires. Many people would react to this as a threat. Basil, however, chose to view it as an opportunity. Over the years, old George has settled into a routine of sending his proxies to crush his enemies. Over the years, his proxies have become increasingly dangerous and unstable. The woman who is not called Marianne is the latest of these, a fearsome instrument of destruction to vampires. Normally, Basil would avoid both of them like the plague. There is nothing to be gained from messing around with old George. But once outside the walls of Dancy House, a plan suggests itself to him. 1. Tempt old George to create a nest of baby vamps. 2. Bring them into the laundry, who will ultimately realize that old George is their creator. 3. Thereby threatening to overturn the law of secrecy. 4. Borrow, not Marianne, on the pretext of suffocating the babies. Seduce her with the gift of fresh meat, buying her temporary collusion. 5. Stripped of his most powerful cat's paw, old George is now in a position where he can only silence the security threat by attacking an organization he has been aware of, but has avoided any connection to for a very long time. 6. Make sure that old George believes Basil to be on the premises, when, in fact, Basil is elsewhere at the time of the attack. If old George is killed, Basil will shed no tears. And if old George succeeds, those of us who might expose Basil will be eliminated. From Basil's point of view, it's a win-win situation. It's cold-blooded, of course, but it's hard to make an omelette without breaking eggs. I find it very hard to write this account objectively, so I am going to quote extensively from the report of the Board of Inquiry, with added comments of my own. At the top of the stairs, old George paused to orient himself. Then he turned and headed down the corridor between the Operational Research Unit offices on one side and the Admin and Facilities Cubicle Farm on the other. Turning right, he came to the general office fronting the Department of External Affairs, and here he encountered Doris Green from Health and Safety. We do not know exactly what Doris was doing outside Briefing Room 203, which was occupied at the time by the Task Alpha Group established by the senior auditor to which she had been assigned. For obvious reasons, CCTV coverage of the new annex premises stops at the front door. Jez Wilson indicated at the inquiry that she believes Doris was simply taking a break to powder her nose, but cannot provide definite confirmation for this theory. Certainly, to get to the nearest ladies' toilet from briefing room 203, Doris would have had to turn right, walk past briefing rooms 204 to 210, descend the north staircase, turn left through the fire doors, and go through the corridor leading past the DEA cluster, which is exactly where her body was found. Doris Green, age 56, leaves a husband, Martin, age 59, and three children, Peter, age 31, Emma, age 29, and Carol, age 26. Old George did not pause to feed or attempt to coerce his victims into obedience. He merely touched them with a fingertip and killed them. His touch carried an abstruse contagion, an anti-pattern for life, an invocation of a kind that can only be generated by someone who has consumed far too much of it. No soul-eating is involved. Victims are simply thrown away, minds shredded, brains stilled, hearts stopped. There is no indication that Doris Green offered, or was capable of offering, any resistance. The Board of Inquiry located the next body just beyond the second-floor fire doors fronting the north stairwell, in the corridor outside the door to briefing room 210. Four bullet holes were found, in two groups, in the left fire door. The gun that fired them, a standard-issue Glock 17, was found in the right hand of Mr. Andrew Newstrom. One round was chambered, and 12 more rounds were found to be present in the 17-round extended-capacity magazine after the weapon was made safe by forensic investigators. The ammunition load consisted of alternating rounds of hollow-point 9x19mm Parabellum and our own standard banishment rounds, essentially FMJ 9mm, with an embedded banishment circuit in the base of the bullet. Examination of the spent rounds confirmed that the banishment circuits of the two bullets retrieved from the wall beyond the fire door were discharged by contact with a ward of Class 6 or higher strength. The board's conclusion is that the likely course of events was that Mr. Newstrom left briefing room 202, for reasons unknown, encountered old George, and engaged him with his personal defense weapon at close range. He had time to fire four rounds and hit the target repeatedly, but the combined effect of the translocative compulsion wired into old George's coat effectively rendered his target physically immaterial to bullets. Old George advanced at walking pace, covering 6 meters of physical distance, and touched Mr. Newstrom before he could fire again. Andy Newstrom, aged 47, leaves a wife, Sandra, age 49, and two children, Alec, 15, and Olivia, 11. 15 meters farther down the corridor, the door to room 203 was locked. Briefing room 203 was occupied at the time of the incident by Jez Wilson and Gerald Lockhart, who had returned empty-handed from his errand to retrieve Oscar Menendez. The board's findings note that Wilson and Lockhart survived the incident principally due to their quick thinking in locking the door in response to the shots fired by Mr. Newstrom. As a result, old George bypassed room 203. The board finds that neither Lockhart nor Wilson were equipped to survive a confrontation with old George or to impede his progress. Had they attracted the attention of the intruder or attempted to engage him, they would certainly be numbered among the dead. Jez and Jerry were frantically piling furniture behind the door at precisely the moment my call to the duty officer's room connected. The next body was found just outside briefing room 203. It belonged to Dr. Judith Carroll, the ranking auditor with internal affairs, and second in command to Dr. Michael Armstrong. Indications of intense thaumaturgic discharge were found around this body. Dr. Carroll's ward of office was discharged. In the process, it combusted and the metal trimmings melted. The body was extensively burned. Scorch marks were found on the walls and ceiling to either side, as well as on the body. A residual high thorm count renders a 3-meter section of the corridor hazardous for traversal, and extensive decontamination and exorcism will be required if the second-floor corridor is to be rendered safe for normal use. From the position of the corpse and adjacent spatter patterns, it is inferred that Dr. Carroll left briefing room 202 when she heard Mr. Newstrom open fire on old George. A confrontation then ensued. During this confrontation, Dr. Carroll activated her entire repertoire of personal defense macros and spells. In doing so, she caused extensive damage to old George's coat and disabled the geometry engine supporting its translocative compulsion field. From this point on, old George was no longer immune to gunfire. Old George attempted to apply his thanatic anti-pattern to Dr. Carroll. Dr. Carroll's ward short-circuited it, in the process discharging completely and, per subsequent evidence, inflicting fifth-degree, bone-deep burns on old George's right hand and forearm. Old George appears to have responded with physical force, using his remaining left arm to apply torsion to Dr. Carroll's right elbow, first dislocating her limb at the shoulder, then inducing traumatic amputation. He then used the appendage as a bludgeon to apply blunt trauma to Dr. Carroll's head. The cause of death is unclear, but may include a combination of blood loss, shock, and cerebral swelling secondary to a fractured skull. Dr. Carroll, aged 62, was a widow at the time of the incident. She is survived by a son, Derek, 38. The door to briefing room 202 was open, and this is where the intrusion event terminated. The last two bodies are unaccounted for, but are believed to be located within the containment ward in that room. One of them is that of old George, the other is that of D.S.S. Angleton, also known as the Eater of Souls. The precise sequence of events leading to the loss of D.S.S. Angleton and the 227-year-old vampire known as George Stevenson have not been established as of the date at which the Board of Inquiry issued their interim report. Briefing Room 202 is, as of the time of writing, currently inaccessible due to a residual necromantic thorn field, which is sufficiently intense, at 1200 milliparsons per hour just inside the threshold, to pose a high risk of neurophagic possession to anyone unwise enough to enter. A 4-meter diameter, perfectly spherical event horizon can be observed in the center of the room, but the thorn field rises exponentially as the singularity is approached. Detailed examination is not currently feasible. It is believed that the bodies of D.S.S. Angleton and Old George lie within the event horizon. A narrative account of the encounter between D.S.S. Angleton and Old George is appended to the interim report, but is marked as a provisional finding, and some questions remain over its accuracy. It is believed that, at the time shots were being fired by Mr. Newstrom, D.S.S. Angleton was in briefing room 202, where he was occupied with a phone call from his operational assistant, Mr. Howard. On hearing shots, Angleton ended the call and spoke to Dr. Carroll, who volunteered to investigate. It is noted that Dr. Carroll's ward of office should have given her similar immunity to physical threats to that available to old George, and Dr. Carroll's position as auditor was contingent upon her ability to compel and command. She was, in her own right, a formidable operative, if somewhat rusty, her last field experience being over 2 decades earlier. It is not possible to be sure of D.S.S. Angleton's state of mind at this time, D.S.S. Angleton not being entirely human to begin with, and having occupied his body for at least 82 years at the time of the incident. However, it is inferred that D.S.S. Angleton was aware of an imminent threat from multiple sources, from the sound of gunfire, from Howard's code red warning, and then from the auditor's radiative emissions and subsequent screaming as old George beat her to death with her own arm. It is unclear why D.S.S. Angleton did not immediately enter the corridor and engage old George. It is speculated that D.S.S. Angleton required time to prepare himself for combat. Again, as with Dr. Carroll, Dr. Angleton's last active field operation, if the fiasco 2 years ago at Brookwood Cemetery is excluded, was over 6 years ago. It is also speculated that D.S.S. Angleton assessed Dr. Carroll's triage status as irretrievable and decided to spend almost a minute preparing briefing room 202 to receive old George. Witnesses trapped in briefing room 203 claim to have heard Angleton call out, "In here, George!" in a tone of voice that one bystander described as jolly and another described as chilling. It is not known at this time how D.S.S. Angleton was aware of the attacker's identity. Subsequent witness reports are unreliable and subjective, but paint a picture of a subjective sense of extreme existential dread, nausea, bone-deep aches and feverish chills, hearing arcane chanting in unfamiliar languages, identified by one witness as like old Enochian but different and much scarier, old Enochian with Tourette's syndrome perhaps, inhuman groaning, and an intense and eerie sense of jamais vu. The precise nature of the exchange of thaumaturgic firepower that happened in Briefing Room 202 is unclear, but it should be noted that items subsequently found in old George's possession, both on his person and at his home, indicate that he was a proficient ritual necromancer even before his contraction of Fang syndrome. Furthermore, old George had the benefit of nearly 2 centuries to perfect his technique without fear of Kranzberg syndrome. D.S.S. Angleton, in contrast, was the dead soul of a hungry ghost, bound into the living body of a man whose mind was sacrificed to provide a vessel for the praetor. Both these individuals were combat sorcerers of great age and experience, fighting for their lives, and they paid the ultimate price. D.S.S. James Jesus Angleton, not his real name, aged 102, or unaccountable eons, was single at the time of his departure. He is survived by an assistant who, in the wake of a destiny entanglement accident 2 years ago, shares some of his abilities. And I am now going to stop writing in order to observe a 3-minute silence for the dead, before I bring this sorry story to its close. The police finally move in and secure the scene. Scary organizes. Pete sees to Alex, delivering soothing words, while one of the squaddies works on him from a field first aid kit equipped with morphine and burn dressings. I go through the motions of an after-op report, but it's very hard. I'm back on the phone almost as soon as Angleton hangs up on me, but it takes me a minute to get through to someone who knows what's going on. And by that time, I already know what they're telling me. Angleton, they say, is dead. Or I infer, if not dead, then discarnate, beyond recall unless someone attempts the Teapot Baron Tyburn invocation, which will happen over my dead body. At the moment of his death, I feel a great disturbance in the force, as if millions of voices suddenly cried out in terror and were silenced. Well, no, actually. It's not like Star Wars at all. And there is no luminiferous ether either, dammit. But it's as if I've been wearing a pair of too tight gloves for so long I didn't even notice anymore, and they're suddenly gone. And if I flex my mental fingers, it's like I've been performing resistance exercises and suddenly I've acquired the grip of doom. So I'm not the apprentice, trainee, junior mythbuster, eater of souls anymore. I don't know if you could accurately describe me as the real thing yet, but I'm the nearest we've got now Angleton's gone, and I'll just have to do my best to live up or die down to his standards. It's a lot to come to terms with, especially as I'm shocky and disoriented, covered in blood and other bodily fluids, upset and disturbed by the fallout from Basil's little party, and trying to hold everybody else on the KGB 2YA site together. This shit is highly distracting, even in the absence of knowing that there's a code red in hand, and people keep buzzing around my head like summer blue bottles, nagging me with stupid questions. I will confess to snarling a couple of times, and one or two of the cops push back with a bit of attitude. They're used to their authority being respected, even without the assault rifles and the Darth Vader stormtrooper gear. But it turns out that all I have to do is stare at them, and they urgently remember something else they need to be doing. And, in truth, Scary can handle this circus from now on. Basil is roadkill. Alex is gibbering and confessing to the vicar. Little Miss Serial Killer Squared is giving me a very bad taste in the back of my mouth. And there's a code red in progress back at base. So I walk over to the nearest crimson BMW with Christmas tree lighting and locate the occupant, who is by coincidence conversing with Scary. "I need a ride," I say. The cop turns on me. He's something senior. Inspector, maybe.
"You wait your—"
he begins. Then I make eye contact and his tongue freezes. "I need a ride," I say, reaching deep inside myself for the power and authority that goes with my new job. Do not make me repeat myself. The inspector reels and looks at me like I'm the Grim Reaper. Maybe I need to dial it down a notch or two.
He needs a ride, Scary says, not unkindly. And he's my boss. I reckon you should give him a ride. It's the easiest way to get rid of him.
Right. Where do you need to go, sir?
I give him the new annex's address. I hope to hell I'm not too late. If a motorbike or scooter is the second fastest way to get around London, then a police-armed response car with blues and twos comes a pretty close third. Unfortunately, there's no room for a chopper to set down by the new annex, or I'd requisition one and fuck the budget. I spend the next 20 minutes in a weird hypnagogic state, eyes registering the blue highlights reflecting off the shut shop windows to either side, as we hurtle along high streets like the proverbial chiropteroid making its exit from Tartarus. My mind's a million miles away. All I can think is, someone killed Angleton. Which means they need me because I'm the next in line. Or maybe they need Mo with her instrument, but she's in the North Sea right now. Funny, whatever killed Angleton will probably make short work of me, so she won't even get to yell at me for getting myself killed. My driver begins to slow down, and I realize I recognize the roads. We're nearly there. Then I see more flashing lights, red and blue and white, which is worse. And we round the corner to see a small herd of ambulances drawn up, more police cars, and another Oculus truck setting up a mobile command center, outside a building with strange lights in one of the second-floor windows that make the skin in the small of my back try to crawl off and hide. And stop. I'm clearly too late, which means I'm going to get to live a little longer. Somehow it feels wrong. It's 3 o'clock in the morning in the back of the Oculus truck, parked outside the alleyway at the back of the new annex. It's chilly and winter damp in the back of the truck. I'm cross-eyed with exhaustion as the senior auditor turns to me and clears his throat. There are bluish-purple bags under his eyes, highlighted by the flickering overhead neon tubes. I've never seen him look so frighteningly mortal before.
"Nothing more to do here," he says. "You should go home."
"Thanks," I say, then pause. "You're sure?" He stretches tiredly.
"Colonel Lockhart will come in early, in about another half hour."
Lockhart's a stuffed shirt.
"Yes, but he can handle mop-up. And that's what we're down to. My colleagues will take over in the morning. You've done your bit, you're covered in..."
He hesitates momentarily.
"Stuff. You're bone-tired and you should get some sleep. We will be conducting debriefings all day tomorrow. Don't come in until you've had at least 6 hours' sleep, preferably 12.
"Is that an order?" I jab. He looks at me without the customary twinkle in his eyes.
"You know better than to ask, Mr. Howard."
Oh, great. I stifle a yawn.
"Okay, 6 hours' sleep before the fatal incident inquiry. Check."
Angleton is dead. Andy's dead too, and that's worse in a way. In a lot of ways. Angleton was an ancient monster, but Andy was just another guy, with a wife and kids, trying to kick his smoking habit and learn something new for his 10%er project. And now he's dead, and some poor bloody cop is sitting up late with Andy's wife and children, and wondering how the hell to make a decent withdrawal. Maybe if I hadn't volunteered to help him, he'd still be alive. Then again, if I hadn't volunteered to lend a hand, he was all set to zap himself on that stupid summoning rig he was working on. I don't know. I'll never know. And the terrible part is that right now I'm so tired that I'd rather get some sleep than stay up an extra hour to find out the truth, if that was somehow possible. The SA is right. I need to go home. I stand up. "See you tomorrow afternoon," I say. I strip off my filthy overalls, then stumble down the steps from the back of the Oculus truck, shivering in a t-shirt and jeans. I've got an app for a local minicab firm on my phone, and even though the shattered glass screen crackles when I touch it, it's just about usable. I've got my home address and the new annex bookmarked, and at this time of night there's not much competition for fares. I let myself into the darkened hallway of my own home like a thief in the night, skulking and shivering in unshod feet. I'm tired, with a bone-deep fatigue, to which is added a layer of despair and depression. I've lost co-workers and, dare I say it, friends tonight. To start with, how? Well, no, he wasn't a friend, but I've ridden along with him a number of times, from that crazy hole in reality that opened in Amsterdam to training sessions on Dartmoor. He's helped pull my nuts out of the fire more than once. Now he's gone. Just a smelly stain on my damaged beyond cleaning Google t-shirt to remember him by. And my life is smaller as a result. I shuffle through into the kitchen and switch on the lights on the cooker extractor hood, dim enough not to hurt my eyes or wake up the neighbours. I am a mess. I shrug out of my clothes in the middle of the kitchen floor. There's a basket of clean laundry next to the washer-dryer, and I begin to rummage through it for something clean to wear against my skin, for the long trudge upstairs when...
Bob?
I spin round. Oh, hi. You startled me. It's Mary, hair tousled, still fully dressed. She's staring at my hands, which are the only things between her eyes and my wedding tackle. She yawns, puffy-eyed.
What is this?
Would you wait outside for a mo? I turn my back and bend over the laundry basket again, trying to pretend I'm not bare-ass naked. I fell in someone. I'm filthy.
Why didn't you say? Wait a second.
She turns and hoofs it up the stairs, and returns while I'm hopping around with one leg in a pair of boxer shorts, clutching a bath sheet.
Shower. Now. You'll feel ever so much better for it.
She throws the big towel over me, then gets a good look at my dirties.
Ew. You'll have to tell me all about it.
Why so lively? I complain, fighting back another yawn.
Can't it wait?
I was dozing on the sofa with Spooky, who has been demanding unconditional love and complaining about your absence all day. I was waiting up for you.
She's flittering about, casting shadows, getting on my tits. I can't cope with people who are bouncy at 4 o'clock in the morning.
What happened?
She chirps.
Ops clusterfuck.
I turn and head upstairs, climbing slowly. There's going to be a fatal incident inquiry tomorrow. I need to get some sleep first.
Ops? Oh. Oh dear. Anyone I know?
I bite back the urge to snarl, probably, and close the bathroom door. I lean my forehead against the inside of the door with my eyes shut for a minute, but push myself upright when I feel myself beginning to slide. She's right about the shower. I shed the boxers and towel and step inside, then turn it on from cold. The water warms up quickly enough, but the initial icy shock is positively painful and goes a long way towards temporarily de-scrambling my brain. After a couple of minutes, I'm done. Squeaky clean, but exhausted. I step out of the shower, towel myself dry, then wrap the bath sheet around me and step out onto the landing.
I'm going to bed now,
I tell the airspace above the staircase.
Help yourself to tea and coffee.
I turn the landing light off, shuffle into the bedroom, then drop the towel and slide into my regular side of the bed, which is clammy in the pre-dawn chill. My eyelids slam shut as my head hits the pillow. Delicate fingers form a cup around my balls as a lithe, warm body spoons up behind me, flattening her breasts against my spine and sliding a knee across my hip.
Gotcha,
she breathes in my ear. I'm so drained I barely twitch.
Not funny. I want to sleep. Go away, I grunt.
It's Mary, of course, who is no less unprincipled than ever, if somewhat more single-minded and a lot less obviously crazy. Vampiredom suits her down to the ground. But she's always had a hotline to my libido, and she's rather good with her hands. I may be sleepy, but my wedding tackle isn't. Mary squeezes, and I groan quietly.
Not cool,
I say. I can feel her presence, both with my skin and with an inner sense, the inner eye, dark adapted and far more penetrating than before. And I can see what she is, the dim red spirals in the void behind her eyes.
I begin to struggle, finally waking up and resisting. No, seriously, I want you to stop now. Her hand stops moving.
Bob, what's wrong?
She asks, sounding confused. I want to say, I'm married and unavailable. And I want to say, what we had has been over for years. It'd be better to say, I think you misunderstood the context of my invitation, but that's too complicated a construction for me right now. What comes out is, I'm exhausted and a bunch of my friends are dead and I don't want this.
Poor Bob.
And my wife gets home tomorrow and it's nearly tomorrow already. I yawn. And yesterday I killed a vampire-hunting psychopath and then an ancient and powerful vampire and I feel ill. Mental indigestion.
You killed...
She pauses.
Oh my. God. Bob.
She's shaking. I can feel it through my misery.
What have they done to you? What have they turned you into?
We can't go back. Can't rewind and become what we might have been if we'd done the last decade differently. Please get out of my bed, Mary. The thing that wanted you dead is gone. You're safe. You should go home now. It's not safe for you to be here. Make sure you get undercover before dawn. If you don't go, you'll be stuck here all day tomorrow. A moment passes, then she lets go of me. I feel the covers peel back, and she climbs across me. I feel her brief, cool kiss on my forehead before she leaves. Then darkness descends, leaving me alone in the night with my despair and the memory of her lost humanity. Even if I wasn't married, I don't think I could sleep with her now. Something in the back of my head thinks she's the sort of thing I eat. Doors slam.
Hi, honey, I'm home.
I open my eyes on darkness. The bedside alarm says it's 6 o'clock. Thanks to Mary, I've had only 2 hours of sleep. I try and shake my head to clear the cobwebs, then blink painfully. My eyes are sore. Hi, I call out, rolling over towards the edge of the bed. I tend to sprawl in the middle when I'm alone. Except I'm not alone. Something warm and furry chirps indignantly and jumps out of the way. Blasted cat. At least Spooky doesn't seem to be a face-hugger. Mum's old cat used to do that. Sneak into the bedroom and sleep on my pillow. Sometimes she'd fart in my face. I'm up here, I add. I get my feet on the floor and sit up, then nearly double over in pain. There's a clattering thump from downstairs and a muffled scream, and the base of my right middle finger throbs painfully. It's the counterpart to the signalling ring I gave Mary. An uncanny musical tone wobbles up from below, clawing at my eardrums. No! I yell. I make a dive for the staircase and slap my hand on the light switch. The note dies away to a distant hum, but it leaves a metallic stink in the air, like high-voltage switchgear, or an electric chair just before it is switched on. Mo stands in the hall, just in front of the porch, the ivory-hue violin braced between chin and shoulder, bow resting lightly across the strings. It's aimed like a gun at Mary, who is crouched in the living room doorway. She's half-dressed, and in the green-tinged light from the CFL bulb, she looks as pale as the violin. Lithe and bone-white, her canines extended, she cringes away from Mo, whose posture reminds me of a junkyard dog on the edge of exploding in a murderous frenzy of biting and clawing. "Stand down!" I shout. Instinct makes me duck back round the bedroom door, grab the dressing gown hanging on the back of it, and throw it around myself before I set foot to stair. The foot of the staircase is between the living room door and the kitchen. I reach the bottom and turn. We make an odd triptych. Me, in dressing gown and bare feet. Mary, huddling in the living room doorway with something between a snarl and an ingratiating simper on her face. And my wife, the avenging angel, red hair and gunsight eyes staring over the bridge of her weapon. But she's not moving the bow across the glowing, barely visible superstrings that thread her instrument. Not yet. I try to keep my voice level, speaking clearly and slowly, to be as unthreatening and unsuspicious as possible. We had an internal threat. I told her she could stay here. The threat situation was resolved about 3 hours ago at the new annex. She's about to leave. Mo says nothing, but her eyes narrow, almost imperceptibly, and I see her tighten her grip on the violin.
It's true, Mary says, words tumbling out. There was an elder inside the laundry. He was sending a vampire hunter to murder all the fangs. Bob said he must have access to the personnel records. This would be the last place a vampire hunter would look for me. I've been using the living room. I'll just get my stuff and be going.
Mo breaks eye contact with Mary and looks at me. There is death in her fingertips.
Is this true?
Behind my back, I cross my fingers. Yes, I say firmly. Because it is true. Even though a suspicious little corner of my mind is reminding me that I didn't offer Mary the living room sofa, I offered her the spare bedroom, and what is she still doing here? You invited a vampire into your home, it nudges. You deserve the consequences. It's not the whole truth, but it's the truth, and the full truth will have to wait until the weapons are safed and the tempers are tamed. Mary shuffles backwards into the living room, and from Mo's disinterest and the rustling sounds, I gather she's pulling her clothes together in a hurry. Mo continues to watch me.
You didn't email,
she says, deceptively calmly. I thought you were on a... My eyes involuntarily track towards the living room door. Mary has no need to know. Out of contact.
That's not the point,
Mo says, her voice even and controlled. She's at her most dangerous when she's like this. Chilly and judgmental and poised and calm, like an angel of vengeance.
You invited that thing into our house.
The violin turns away from me, facing into the living room. The ring around my finger throbs. I think even the brief note Mo drew before I shouted at her to stop may have injured Mary. She whimpers quietly, afraid. She's a member of non-operational staff who has contracted an unfortunate but controllable medical condition, Mo. We have a duty to look after our own.
Yes, well, I can see exactly how important that is to you.
Mo abruptly glances away from me.
You,
she hisses. The bow rests lightly across the violin. She tweaks gently between two fingers. The instrument moans like a soul in torment, shivering very quietly.
Keep away from him, you bitch.
Another note, another moan, this one from Mary. The ring throbs, fiery pain that feels as if my finger's about to fall off. My skin crawls, and my hair begins to lift. Static electricity everywhere. Stop hurting her, I hear myself saying. Mo's fingers continue to move. She looks puzzled. Stop, I say, and step towards her.
I can't.
The bow drags slowly across the strings, and Mo's left fingertips begin to bleed. The strings are glowing now, and Mary screams in pain. Mo's eyes widen.
It won't let me.
The bow is dragging her hand. She fights back, but she can't let go. I reach deep inside myself and speak again, dredging up a memory of an ancient language that I didn't know I had. Stop. As I say it, I reach out and grab Mo's right elbow, pinching it right around the nerve plexus. I'm terrified. Terrified for Mary. Terrified for Mo. Terrified for me. But most of all, I'm terrified of the violin. To touch it is death. To hear it is death. And it wants to feed. A gust of chilly winter air blows in from the living room. There's a thudding rattle as Mary bails out of the front window. She's obviously had second thoughts about being trapped in the middle of a domestic argument between the eater of souls and a blood-cursed instrument. Hopefully she's taken all her stuff. The scroll at the end of the violin turns towards me, dragging Mo's hands with it. Stop! I repeat in old Enochian, looking Mo in the eyes. The pale red glow begins to fade from them, but the violin still quivers, hungry for blood. I close my eyes and look at it with my inner vision. Now I can see it for what it is. A ghastly, filthy, cursed thing,
a vampire of the Second Order. Exactly the thing Basil warned us about.
Why couldn't it be a blancmange? I could eat a blancmange, but then I'd inherit the curse.
A part of me is babbling inanely.
You're hurting me,
she says distantly.
I'm sorry.
I relax my grip on her elbow, but I don't let go. I don't want to give the violin a chance to take over again.
Did you have sex with her?
She asks. No. Her fingers, nerveless, release the bow. It clatters to the floor angrily, but separated into its two halves, the instrument can't stop her from lowering its body. Blood trickles down its neck, across the peg box, pooling above the scroll.
You're bleeding, I say. Let me get a towel.
She nods, and I hurry to the kitchen and grab the kitchen roll. By the time I get back, she's laid the violin on top of its open box, so similar in shape to a coffin. I tear off a couple of sheets and she wraps them around her hand. The violin is spotless already. I glare at it. It's difficult to be sure, but I have a feeling it's watching me, the way a hungry lion watches its prey. Kitchen, I add. All our most significant conversations happen in the kitchen, or over food. It seems to be one of the rules of our relationship. Another rule? Don't even think about lying. It's difficult to slip one past someone you've lived with for a decade at the best of times. Unbelievably harder if they're a practitioner. Being good at spotting lies also makes one prone to false positives, mistaking truth for falsehood. It's the besetting curse of counter-espionage. Mo chose, for a few seconds, to believe I was telling the truth. I did not have sex with that woman. Right. But will she still believe me in the cold light of morning?
She's a vampire,
says Mo. She sounds almost surprised. So is that. I glance towards the hall door, and she follows my eyes.
That's different.
The difference is, now it wants me dead. I suspect it tolerated me previously as a necessary support for its symbiont, but now, with my inner eye, I can see it quivering in the darkness, coiled, ready to pounce. You know that, don't you?
When it turned on you, it was horrible.
Her shoulders are shaking.
Oh, God, that was awful.
She peers at me.
Bob, how did you stop it? You shouldn't have been able to.
Angleton's dead.
What?
The code read last night. The intruder was an ancient fang. He killed Angleton.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
She looks directly at me, and actually takes in my face for, I think, the first time since she walked in the door.
Bob. Oh my God.
She reaches out across the table, and I take her hand. It's shivering like a frightened bird. Bits of white tissue cling to the still raw slashes that crisscross the older scars on her fingertips.
You're him now?
Not really. Not even close. But I have access to a lot of... I trail off. The files stored in Angleton's Memex are waiting for me. I'm probably the only person who knows how to use the bloody thing, much less is authorized to use it without spontaneously catching fire. That's all the knowledge I've inherited from him. But knowledge and power aren't the same thing. Stuff.
What are you going to do?
I look past her shoulder at the elephant in the room, or rather, at the monster in the hallway. With my human eyes, it appears to be a musical instrument, albeit made from unusual and grotesque materials. But with my dark, adapted inner eye, I can see what it is. It's the colour of all the blood that it's drunk over the years, bloated and turgid, bulging against the walls and ceiling, like a tick sized to feed on tyrannosaurs. It's not shaped like a violin at all. It's got too many legs, and a proboscis, and other organs. It's as alien as a parasitic wasp seen under an electron microscope. And it's watching me with patient hatred, because it wears a choke chain and leash, and I'm one of the buzzing irritants that keeps its handler from letting it off the lead. Or maybe it just recognizes its own kind. It's a naked lunch moment. the instant when you freeze and see for the first time what's on the end of your fork. Or in my case, Moe's tuning fork. I should destroy that thing. She looks at me with pity and cynicism.
They won't let you. The organization needs it. It's all I can do to keep squashing the proposals to make more of them.
Yes, but if I don't, it's going to try and kill me again. I know it's true the moment the words leave my mouth. It'll wait. It's patient. But she has to practice daily in an elaborately warded anechoic chamber. And she carries it everywhere, takes it to bed. I don't think she's a natural sleepwalker, but I wouldn't put it past the violin to make her. Sometimes she mumbles and cries out in her sleep.
I can't let go of it.
She bites her lower lip.
If I let go of it, return it to supplies, convince them I can't carry it anymore, they'll just give it to someone else. Someone inexperienced. It was inactive for years before they gave it to me. Starving and in hibernation. It's awake now. And the stars are right.
The picture she's painting doesn't bear thinking about. I feel like I'm being backed into a corner by the inexorable logic of the situation. My skin feels clammy and my heart is pounding. What are we going to do? It wants me dead.
If I let go of it, a lot of other people will die, Bob. I'm the only thing holding it back. Do you want that? Do you really want to take responsibility for letting it off the leash with an inexperienced handler?
Our eyes meet. 10 years of love, pity, and regrets are all wrapped up in a single moment. I take a deep breath and say the words that I've somehow known were coming for the past few weeks, ever since our sushi date with Destiny. I'm going to have to move out.
The End. You've been listening to The Rhesus Chart by Charles Stross, narrated by Gideon Emery. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Wireless Stories by Charles Stross, narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds, Gideon Emery, Paul Hecht, and Robert Ian McKenzie. In this collection of short stories, Charles Stross delivers a wide variety of speculative fiction, showcasing the limitless imagination of one of the 21st century's most daring visionaries. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.